If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Now, here's Ira.
The Sound Podcast is part of the OSIRIS Network. OSIRIS connects you with podcasts, videos, and live experiences about the artists and topics you love. Visit OSIRISPod.com to check out our shows. In fact, you should check out No Simple Road or Inside Out with Turner and Seth. Both are great shows. OSIRIS works in partnership with Jambase, which connects music fans with the music they love and empowers them to go see live music. For more, check them out at jambase.com. The show starts now. You've been listening to My Girl is a Heartbreak from British duo Ida May. I first heard about Ida May when I actually heard them open for the Marcus King Band here in Toronto back in November. I was impressed by the duo who combined an acoustic rock sound with a gentler country blues thing. The couple's chemistry is something to behold, and before any rumors start, Chris Turpin and Stephanie Jean are in fact married. They have received critical acclaim already from Rolling Stone magazine and other media outlets. Their debut record, Chasing Lights, isn't out until June, but in the interim, they are on the road opening for Blackberry Smoke. The truth is, the duo were in another outfit called Kill It Kids some years back, and so it only seemed natural to start my conversation with Chris Turpin asking why the switch to Ida May came about.
Oh, there's a lot of different reasons, really. The main being that we'd signed a pretty crummy record deal with Warner Brothers on our old band, and we've been pushed around basically a little bit by the record company. We'd gotten to 3 records, and we hadn't really had the impact that we'd hoped to have had. And I initially started the band and named it Kill It Kid after a 1920s Blind Willie McTell song. Mm-hmm. I'm in love with early American country blues, and right. Blind Willie McTell used to sing with his wife. And there was one song in particular called God Don't Like It and I Don't Either, which when I first heard that when I was, 17 or something, just blew my mind, and that's what I wanted to do. And more we'd been pushed away from that into this heavier rock, blues, grunge territory. And it just felt like the right moment to pull it back to where we began, basically, and what we were trying to do in the first place. I feel like we've gone off message a bit. So, that's why we started Ida May and got out the contracts and started afresh.
And was... I realize on the record, the producer plays drums, but is the goal mostly to be Ida May as a duo? Is that the goal here with this project?
Sort of. Well, at the moment, it sort of started that way, which is good, 'cause it's pretty economical to tour that way.
Sure.
And I think it's like we've already found playing as a duo. You know, when we played for Marcus King, we could gear it up and get a little heavier.
Right.
When we were opening for Greta Van Fleet, we could get even heavier again with the slide guitar. Now with Blackberry Smoke, you know, we can almost pare it down to like a country thing, and very much more Americana. So we're actually a lot more flexible, is what we love about playing out as a duo, is that you're able to change to your audience, your surroundings, who you're playing for, what the vibe is that night. You know, if it's a rainy Tuesday night, you could play completely differently to a drunken Friday night or something. And we're really enjoying that. But in terms of the record, I will often see records as a different thing. I think you should be allowed to open up and record differently and play differently than you do live. So we want to scale it up later on to have more of a drummer. And we're starting to play with a double bass player back in the UK and Europe who was on the record, a great guy called Nick Peeney. Mm-hmm. And we've started to play with him. And he's been amazing because, like a double bass, you can get percussion sounds, you can get drums, it can get heavy, but it stays groovy. And very quickly we realized playing with him, we're going to want to get some drums involved soon. So I think we'll scale it up and scale it down depending on what we're doing and how it's going and, you know, where we're playing, basically.
I'm curious about the country blues connection because you're in England, and while there have been many rock bands who have come before you that have been very interested in the country blues, I'm curious about how you found those records and how you got into that kind of music.
Yeah, it's really strange why suburban British kids get into blues. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever, really. But for me, it was the Detroit rock and roll scene that happened about 10, 15 years ago,
right,
with the Von Bondies and the Go and the early White Stripes. And someone mentioned in an interview, I think, Sun House. I went back into HMV and traced a Sun House by Willie McTell and Robert Johnson and bought everything that ever recorded for like a fiver or something, £5.
Wow.
And put it on when I got home, and I just couldn't believe what I was hearing, that much sort of ferocity and intensity could come out of one human being and a guitar. Just completely blew my mind because I never heard anything like it. And, you know, and those old recordings are sort of distorted and overdriven, which is really, really cool. And it had a thing that I'd never heard before, basically. And I was hooked after that. And I was into Jimi Hendrix, Fleetwood Mac, and John Mayall, and the Blues Breakers and stuff like that. And pretty quickly, when you listen to that stuff, you get back to the blues, you know, yeah, that's where you're headed.
For sure, for sure.
When you listen to that stuff, you know.
It's interesting that you mention the White Stripes because, well, there's two of you on stage. And while Stephanie doesn't necessarily play a full kit, the comparables are there in terms of tone, in terms of sound. But, you know, what do you make of that comparison? Because I think it's actually a little bit weak. I think that, yes, you're a male and a female on stage. And, yes, the White Stripes were as well. But it's a little bit more dynamic than that, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's easy. I mean, I know everything, you know. It's much easier to quantize things and to put people into boxes to make it easier for listeners and fans of to go and enjoy other people's music. But for us, I mean, it would be so easy for us to, you know, to get a kick drum, to get a bit more of a drum kit, to use an octave pedal and da-da-da and make it that big thing. But that's really not what we're about. You know, for us, it was all about boiling it back down to the bare essentials after being in a rock and roll band. So the song to take center stage and our voices to take center stage and warts and all, whatever mistakes we make, to not be covered up by anything. So if we're playing in a bar acoustically without a PA system, you know, we can carry hopefully the same weight as, you know, in a stadium with a big PA system or whatever. You know, it's about boiling it down to the bare essentials. And this is why, like you say, on the, you know, the record, we've got more players, we've got bits and pieces, but really it's just about, you know, it's almost easier to dress things up and make them bigger as well, you know, to have more fuzz pedals and distortion and overdrive, because you can hide behind that. And we found that very much in our rock and roll band as well. We could hide behind the wall of sound that you can create. Whereas when you're a duo with a single guitar to hide behind, there is nowhere to hide. And it's pretty scary sometimes, especially for us as, you know, for example, you know, us last night playing in Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
You know, in front of the Blackberry Smoke audience, playing essentially American music, you know, covering Fred McDowell songs from Mississippi or whatever.
Right.
You know, we're pretty thin-skinned up there. So we really have to engage with people and get people to open up and to talk to us and get it. You know, we can't hide. So, yeah, the comparisons, I think, are entirely appropriate. But it's, yeah, we're doing a very different thing, that's for sure.
I want to get to some of the songs on the record, but before we do, I want to talk about songwriting. Is it a combination of both you and Stephanie Jean writing these songs, or is it mostly you, or is it mostly her? How does that piece come together?
Yeah, well, it's mainly me at the moment, mainly me, but Steph works more as an editor, so she would chop and change lyrics and move things around, da-da-da. And a lot of them are co-written on the album as well, like Sweet Abandon is a co-write, and a few others on there just wouldn't be the songs they are without us together writing. But it's safe to say that I'm sort of the main writer, but then I have a lot of ideas and move around all over the place with different songs and shapes of things that actually it makes a lot of, it's kind of integral having her to cast her eye over
right
everything and pull it all together for it to make sense. And even down to like part writing and stuff like that on the record, when we're writing parts and the music and stuff, that's pretty much on the fly. Steph's an amazing keys player. She sessions for Ethan as well as playing for us. So she was on Mary Chapin Carpenter's record that just happened, and she's been on a few others. She's a great keys player, so a lot of what you hear, the licks and the riffs and the melodies on the record, will be written by her pretty much on the fly in the studio. So there's a lot of writing there in that respect.
Well, let's talk about some of the songs, and I am going to start with If You Don't Love Me, because, well, it's the antithesis of the White Stripes thing, and more to the point, it's a beautiful ballad, and I think it showcases the potential, A, the songwriting, but B, the performance in such an exquisite way, and of course, Rolling Stone Country named it one of the 10 best country and American songs to hear right now, which must have been a thrill. How did that song come together for the two of you?
Yeah, that was amazing to hear that. Well, that was one of those songs where we, you know, because we just got engaged at the beginning of this record, we thought, you know, screw it. If we're going to write love songs, it's probably going to be now. And just to make a real simple song, really. And it came together quite quickly. I'd actually written the verses of that quite a while ago. And we sort of put the chorus on maybe a year or so later. But the main, that is an interesting one, because when we were recording with Ethan, you know, having been in a rock and roll band, you know, we can sing pretty loud and scream and shout and jump around.
Right.
But he was really like, you know, look, we're going to work in really, really quick takes. You know, we're going to do maybe three passes of the song, and I want you to sing in almost your speaking voice. So break it down to the bare minimum. He said, you know, that way you can holler and shout and sing like you have done in the past, you need to be doing that 2% of the time. And most of the time you need to be almost talking the song, which is completely new to me, because it almost feels like you're not singing.
Right, right.
And that was the first time he really pushed to keep it really quiet and soft and gentle. Like, you know, you're speaking the lyrics. The whole performance of that song was completely new to us. And I think live now we probably up it and make it a bit rockier than it is. So that's how that song came together. And that was all done live. I think that was probably about a second or third take. I think we used the end of the third and, right, and most of the second take, all live, straight to tape, quite late at night. And I think you can sort of hear that on that one.
It's an amazing performance, like I said, and you can tell that it certainly was recorded live because it has that energy. I'm glad that you mentioned Ethan because, his track record speaks for itself in terms of being a producer and working with talent and making some, let's face it, some incredible records, whether they're Ryan Adams records or Ray LaMontagne records or, Kings of Leon records. I mean, it's some of my favorite records he's played a part in. I'm curious about how you hooked up with him and how much he added to or distilled your sound before you went into the studio.
Yeah, that was a dream come true for us. And it really was a big moment because we'd waited, you know, our years up until then playing music and touring. He was always top of our list. Like without doubt, he was top of the list. That's who we wanted to work with. And we actually worked with a lot of different producers before him. We worked with a lot of pop producers, so like mm-hmm. James Blaze guy and Ed Sheeran's guy, because we've worked through quite a lot of record companies basically to get this record out. That's a whole other story. We started the record on Universal, mm-hmm. on Decca. We finished it with Seymour Stein on Sire, and now it's coming out on 30 Tigers.
Right.
So in there lies a huge journey. But Ethan was the last piece of the jigsaw, basically. We worked with these other people. We worked with M. Ward as well. We went out to Portland, Oregon, and worked with him and had a great time. Ethan came in at the last minute and said, I want to meet those guys.
Right.
And none of our management really knew what that meant, except we were given an address and be there at this time. So we disappeared off to his house and met him in the wilds of Somerset in England. And we went out to his wood-burning stove in one of his sheds, basically at the back of his house, and spoke about music for 10 hours and stayed for lunch and stayed for dinner. And then at the end of it, we said, well, look, Ethan, we'd love for you to do the record if you want to. And he was like, oh, well, I'd love to. I never take it for granted. Absolutely fantastic. And anyway, so he settled into doing the record, and he had a huge impact on how the record sounded, because of, I think the main thing with Ethan is, there's been zero compromise in anything he's ever made. When he was making those Kings of Leon records and he was making the Ryan Adams records, and Ray LaMontagne, who he helped to discover, he did everything on his gut instinct, essentially. Mm-hmm. So what felt right to him was what went down on the tape, and he didn't compromise for the record companies or anything like this. He would slam phones down, say he's not changing mixes. He was a completely curmudgeonous asshole, basically. Yeah, because he's so passionate about what he does and how he does it.
Yes.
And also because all of his main successes have been off the back of this sort of belligerent attitude, basically, to what he thinks things should sound like. So he had a huge impact in that pre-production was essentially going through the lyrics of the songs and the shapes of the songs and what we could add to them. There was no running it with a band. There was no rehearsing. There was no anything like that. And that by the time we got to actually recording, we had the conversation about vocals. And I said, are we sure we should do the vocals live? And he said, well, if you can, you should. Why wouldn't you set yourself up to fail? Why would you not? Right. I think it was the first day there was one part of my vocal, and If You Don't Love Me, that I wasn't sure about. And he swung the chair around and said, look, we're going to have this conversation now. I'm reacting to your vocals, your vocal performance on a purely emotional level. I'm not listening to the technical butt parts. I'm not listening to the diction. I'm not feeling any of that. I'm just feeling the narrative of how you're singing it. So I have the final say on what vocals go down on the record. He was like, you can have input absolutely on everything, but at the end of the day, wow, I get to choose. Because I'm, you know, and that was quite a scary thing to hear when you're sat down to do your own record. But at the same time, it was a huge weight lifted because, you know, I trust his opinion. So it was like, if it's good enough for him, shit, it's more than good enough for us.
Right.
So that was a pretty amazing thing to feel. And also just in the way we recorded, recording live, straight to tape, you know, literally like for tracks like Through Them Getting Closer and My Girl's a Heartbreak, we probably played the song through half before we started rolling the tape.
Right.
You know, Ethan knew the song. We didn't talk about parts. We didn't talk about how it was going to go down. We just, because we're capable musicians and he's capable musicians and he works with good engineers, we just let it happen really, really sort of immediately. And that's how he likes to work. He likes to capture that sort of sincere, sort of nervous energy that comes with early takes.
Sure.
And we didn't believe it was true until we go back and listen to the first take as opposed to the fourth take. And he was completely right. You know, the early takes would have something that the later takes wouldn't. So, not always the case, but probably 90% of the time he was right. So it had a huge impact on how the record sounds. I think that Dave Cobb is a more modern example of what Ethan does. You know, I think Dave Cobb has a similar aesthetic. But, you know, it's not a popular way to record these days because, one, the record company, you know, they're always pushing for singles and, you know, radio tracks or what have you,
right?
And they want it pumped, they want it loud, they want it the vocal really far forward, they want it really bright and compressed and limited. Ethan just doesn't do that. He just doesn't make records that way. He doesn't think it sounds good. So, you know, you have to enter into his world to some extent to get results that he wants, you know.
The juxtaposition of "You, If You Don't Love Me" to "My Girl Is a Heartbreak" is fairly overwhelming. So I would imagine that you didn't record those back to back, and that you did take some time in between in between those songs.
Yeah, in fact, well, we ended up with the early record company. We ended up doing the ballads first.
Uh-huh.
In a studio called Distiller Records, and then we did the heavier tracks, some of the heavier tracks in Real World Studios, Peter Gabriel's place, in a separate batch. So they were done in sort of two batches, yes. Yeah.
I read about, there is a Dweezil Zappa connection, which I think is outstanding, and people unfortunately won't get to hear Boom 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 till the record comes out, probably in June. So he heard about you guys and he reached out over Instagram. Is that right?
Yeah, this is completely weird. Yeah.
Well, it's Dweezil Zappa, so it's to be expected.
Yeah, it's to be expected, I guess. Yeah, we were I'm like a bit of a guitar geek and I love vintage guitars and playing guitar, and I have an Instagram where I sort of do more guitar based stuff and I'll share what I'm playing, what I'm up to. And he, I don't know, for whatever reason, started commenting on my posts. I must have come up in his feed and I thought, this is a bit weird. Am I being spammed by Dweezil Zappa? What's going on here? And he was doing the Zappa Play Zappa tour, and when we were living in London before we moved out to Nashville, and he was playing the Royal Festival Hall right on the Thames, sold out show, and the night before he messaged me on Instagram and says, hey, do you want to come and sit in on Cosmic Debris, and we're playing the Royal Festival Hall tomorrow.
Wow.
And obviously I pissed my pants and said, absolutely no way. And then I thought about it. Steph said, well, we have to do it. You can't say no. So we go down the next day and say, yeah, we'll come and play. Steph ends up singing harmonies on it. And I end up on stage with Dweezil Zappa doing solos and Cosmic Debris in front of this huge crowd. And just kind of blew my mind because there hadn't been a focus on my guitar playing really in the last band. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sort of at the center of anything I've done before. It's only now I'm starting to play a bit more and sort of, you know, opening up a bit. So anyway, we said we'd love to collaborate with you in another way if we can later on. So when we did this song on the record, I was like, hey, Dweezil, let me send you it and you can put something on it. And he said he'd love to. So he did, and he put that sort of insane, incredible Nintendo 64 guitar solo.
Yeah.
And it was so wild that we had to put it. It's going to be the first track on the record. So, yeah.
Amazing.
It's pretty
amazing.
Cool. I feel very flattered that he would do it.
Continued success. I think that's the best thing. You know, you've had an opportunity to open for Greta Van Fleet, who are countrymen. Oh no, they're from here. Sorry. But you had an opportunity to open for Greta Van Fleet. You've had an opportunity to open for Marcus King Band. You're on the road right now with Blackberry Smoke. And even though while talking to you, you certainly don't sound like a Nashvillian, it makes a lot of sense that you live there now and that you've embraced this music. And in fact, people see you and embrace what Ida Mae is doing. And I think that's fabulous. You are touring through much of March and April with Blackberry Smoke. And what's the plan after that?
Well, we have a couple of other really exciting looking supports that I can't announce yet that are going to be across the US. One with quite a big rock and roll band and one with a country band if it pulls off. but yeah, we have festivals in Dale, Texas and Colorado and a few others, and we're back over to Europe again by the end of the summer. But we're pretty much nonstop now until August is the plan, so we're just rolling with it. And as well, I should say, on this point of American and English music combining, there was a really interesting guy at the show the last show we did in Lexington, and we were talking about music, and he's like, you know, he basically said that it makes sense that people are embracing us here a little more, because, you know, if you sing songs about the same thing, about hard work, it comes from the same moral standpoint, same background, the same things are important to you, then it resonates across an audience. It doesn't matter where you're from. And I think as well, the whole American English thing, it's such an important relationship, man. When I first moved to Nashville, I picked up a book of Missouri folk songs, of lyrics and songs collected in the early 1800s and notated, you know, a bit like the Anna Lomax thing. And all of the songs in that book, there were songs about Yorkshire, where my dad is from in England. There are songs about Ireland, where Steph's family are from. There are songs about East Anglia, where I grew up in England. And you really realize that it's such recent history between the two countries, and that the sort of cross-pollination of our bands across the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s mm-hmm. is just remarkable. And it's you know, a couple of people have said to me, now, why are you playing sort of American music? Well, sort of like, well, we're not playing American music. We're playing sort of Anglo-American music, just like the Beatles or the Stones or anything that happened before it.
Yes.
It's a real special relationship, and I'm just really happy. I mean, coming out, you know, playing in Jackson, Mississippi, and playing Booker White songs to people that live there, it's pretty surreal. it's been amazing. I'm very glad, very lucky to be out playing these shows, that's for sure.
Thanks so much for taking the time. We're very excited about the record release. We're excited to see you guys do amazingly well, and certainly, you know, it was cold when we saw you last here in Toronto, but you definitely heated up the room as appropriately as you could for Marcus, and we appreciate it. So thanks for taking the time again.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We appreciate it. Thank you.
So much in-depth coverage of the songwriting process, being an Englishman making pretty American music, and an amazing insight into the recording process with legendary producer Ethan Johns. I can tell you that the album is absolutely solid from start to finish, but Ida Mae shines in a live setting. You definitely will want to check them out on the road and check out their album when it comes out. It's best if you follow Ida Mae on social media like Dweezil Zappa did, or check their website at idamaemusic.com for more information. Before we leave you, let's have a listen to another track off their forthcoming record. Here is If You Don't Love Me.
I will be the south of France. When your day is dragging, I will scream like Friday night. When your parties run dry, I'll be water into wine. If you don't love me, I won't be loved. If I can't love you, there'll be no one else. And when the traffic stands still, I will be your tungsten tank. And when your feet won't carry, I can roll like a tree. And when you feel you're falling, I will meet you in the air. If you don't love me, I won't be loved. I can't love you, there'll be no one else. If you don't love me, I won't be loved. I can't love you, I don't want love.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. The Sound Podcast is part of the Osiris Network. For more, visit OsirisPod.com. Thanks for listening.
Osiris.